I'm Kata Schwain. I teach at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. I write poetry. I care about it deeply. I like talking about it. I like getting in there and discussing it, as I know all of you do too. So this week we're talking about quote-unquote great poems, and we've been wrestling with this definition of what makes a poem great, right? And just to refresh our memory, we've said that great poems speak to you on first reading, that you get some sort of feeling, whether it's an image, whether it's a narrative story that you like, whether it's just a feeling, whether it brings up questions for you, whatever it is, you get something out of it on first reading, and then you keep getting things out of it on subsequent readings. It keeps speaking to you. We started talking last time about whether a quote-unquote great poem should have both intellectual and emotional effects on the reader. And some people thought that that was maybe true, and some people didn't think that that was maybe true. So that's maybe something we can talk about more today. Second thing, we talked about music. Poem should have music in it. We talked about formal intentionality, that is, whatever the form is, we should feel like the poet knows what he or she is doing, that they're using the form to help create meaning or feeling or emotion or music or whatever it is in the poem. We feel like there should be attention to language. Somebody yesterday brought up the idea of imagination and also the idea of the image as being really embedded in that idea of imagination, right? It's around the image. And somebody else talked about how all of these parts need to be able to be integrated, that they work together to create even larger meaning. The one thing I want to talk a little bit about today, perhaps, is context. That is, should a poem speak to its time? To its place in time in some way? Should we, at some level in reading a poem, be able to tell where it's situated? That's one question, sort of about historical context. Another is sort of its poetic context. Should a poem give us a sense of what other poets of that particular time or generation are doing? Or should it be pushing against that? Or is either okay? Just other thoughts. That we just haven't talked about those things as much yet, so I just want to throw those in to the mix. Yeah. Yes. So today we're talking about a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks, who's an African-American poet, lived 1917 and died in 2000. She won the Pulitzer in 1950 for the book of poems out of which the poem, today's poem, is taken. And though this is, I'd say, one of her less anthologized poems. Yes, I'm trying to think if I can say anything more about that before we get started. No. Okay. Let me... Actually, before I even hand this out, I want to talk about this little poem that I've composed and written on the board here. But I hope someday will become a great poem. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. kidding. All right. Bob, or would somebody like to read it? Anyone feeling brave? Martha, I heard you kind of read it before.
I can read it. Sure. Mm-hmm. Bobby and Sarah, married for years. Bob likes whiskey, porn, and tears. Sarah feels trapped. Bobby feels free. That's how you spell misogyny.
Okay, well, whether we agree with the statements in there or not, when you hear the rhythm, the cadences of this poem, what are you reminded of? What kind of poem? Does that make sense? Maybe not. Maybe I'm not asking that correctly. What is the, okay, how about this other one that goes, Bobby and Sarah sitting in a tree. How does it go? How does that one go?
Yeah, it's S-I-N-G.
First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes the baby. not so good. Would that have the same or different effect than hearing it like this? Or how does the effect change? What does hearing it like this do?
Trivialize.
Okay. Other people?
It's jarring.
Jarring? Okay, you laughed, right, in this trivializing sense?
Right.
But did you laugh in the same way that you would to a nursery rhyme? Like, were you like, or was it more like, ha-ha, uncomfortable kind of laughter, right? Ha-ha, right? Like that kind of thing. In a way that if I just said Bobby and Sarah in kind of a bad relationship, you wouldn't have been like, ha-ha, right? I mean, you probably would have nodded your head, and right? So, tell me your name again.
Pete,
okay. So at the end of yesterday's session, Pete came up to me, and we worked through this, for those of you that weren't there, this kind of difficult Gerard Manley Hopkins poem. And he came up and he said, why doesn't he just say what he means? What's all this, like, blah, blah, all these words and play and everything like that? And why doesn't he just say what he means? And what I want to suggest today is that poems don't do that because poems want to mean, but they also want to make you feel. They also want to get into your body. And so part of the way that they mean is by feeling. And if I just say, Bobby and Sarah are in a bad relationship, which is what I mean, it doesn't make you feel the way it feels like if I say it in this sing-songy way that kind of makes you laugh, but kind of makes you uncomfortable, because it's drawing on things like music, things like that are at odds with one another a little bit. So there's discomfort because of the rhythm. The rhythm adds another layer of discomfort to just what's being said. Does that make sense? So it's having this double effect on you. So in part, I want to lead with this because the poem that we're looking at today, the question that I'm going to ask is, when we first read it, it seems to have one clear meaning. She seems to be wanting to say one clear thing. The question is her form, that is the way that she's choosing to say that, is it, like when we said the rhyme, Bobby and Sarah sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G, right? That, that form, that rhythm, we would say is running parallel, is in concert with, is connected very closely to the meaning, right? It's this fun, happy story about Bobby and Sarah, and the rhythm and the tone sound happy too. Does that make sense? But sometimes, like in this one, the poet is working with what's being said and how they're saying it, and sometimes there's a collision of that, and so there's a different meaning that comes out. That we have to be thinking of both of those things, both what the poet is saying and how they are saying it, in order to really understand the full meaning of the poem. Does that make sense? You'll understand more what I'm saying, I think, when we read it, too. But I just really want to pay attention to that today. So, without further ado. That would feel comfortable reading this kind of cold.
Like, are we still sure?
I think there's more coming around. Is everyone going to get one? Yeah? Everybody have one? Perfect. Anybody that feels comfortable reading it cold? Okay, yeah, great.
First fight, then fiddle. Ply the slipping string with feathery sorcery. Muzzle the note with hurting love. The music that they wrote bewitch, bewilder. Qualify to sing threadwise. Devise no salt, no hempen thing for the dear instrument to bear. devote the bow to silks and honey. Be remote a while from malice and from murdering. But first to arms, to armor. Carry hate in front of you and the harmony behind. Be deaf to music and to beauty blind. Win war. Rise bloody, maybe not too late for having first to civilize a space wherein to play your violin with grace.
Can we read it one more time?
Yes, yes. Is there anybody else that would like to volunteer to read it through?
First fight, then fiddle. Ply the slipping string with feathery sorcery. Muzzle the note with hurting love. The music that they wrote bewitch, bewilder. Qualify to sing threadwise. Devise no salt, no hempen thing for the dear instrument to bear. Devote the bow to silks and honey. Be remote the while from malice and from murdering. But first to arms, to armor. Carry hate in front of you and harmony behind. Be deaf to music and to beauty blind. Win war, rise bloody, maybe not too late for having first to civilize a space wherein to play your violin with grace.
So, can anyone just sort of quickly summarize the sort of, or how could we, just using words from this poem, summarize the message, or the superficial seeming message?
The first four words
yes.
to summarize it.
Yes.
First we fight, and then we can have space to fill.
Yes. Okay. Seemingly, this seems to be the message. So part of what we're going to try to figure out is this poet being sincere? Is this a trustworthy speaker? Is this ultimately her message to us? Or is she telling us something else through other moments in the poem, through other messages? Formal elements, ways of thinking about it, okay? That's kind of the question we're going to be wrestling with as we work through. Does that question make sense to everyone? Yeah? Okay. So let's start at the beginning. First fight, then fiddle. What do you notice so far?
Lots of
alliteration.
Alliteration? Yeah, and what did you say?
I just said last half switch is alliteration.
Alliteration, yes. First fight, then fiddle. So we're being told to first fight and then fiddle, but there's also a very close attention to language already, right? What else do you notice? Yeah, do what you did again.
Oh, well, the rhythm is.
Yes, staccato. Yeah. Yep, and what kind of language is this?
Commands.
Commands, right? So we're already kind of in almost, well, what's, where else might you hear that kind of language that has a lot of imperatives and is staccato?
Military.
Yes. All right, so first fight, then fiddle, right? We're jumping right to what's going on, right? Anything else you want to say about those first two lines?
Imperative,
militarist. Okay. First fight, then fiddle. Ply the slipping string with feathery sorcery. What do you guys notice about this one?
Suddenly the language is soft.
Okay, there's a softening of the language. Yes, and what is now, what's the speaker talking about?
Playing the fiddle.
The music part,
the music,
right?
Yeah.
So suddenly the language is softened, we're talking about it. What about, what about these words like sorcery? What do you think?
I think of like putting a spell on somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something like it's.
Mm-hmm.
That something is being acted upon rather than acted with.
Okay. Yep. How about sound wise? The lightness, the feathery, and the sorcery, right, kind of go together. What else?
a similar thought, because to me, slipping string also sounds a little bit lynchy.
Okay. Okay. But slipping string also we're getting the alliteration in too, right? Alliterative. And sorcery, we talked about this a little bit. Sorcery and things came up a little bit on Monday with our poem. And sorcery can be fun and playful and interesting, but it can also be scary or weird or uncontrollable, right? It can also leave us feeling a little bit uneasy. Deadly.
Can it be magical, too?
Yeah. Wait, did you say can it be magical?
Magical?
Yeah.
Because you think of some of these amazing violinists, how
yes.
it's like magic, how they can
yes.
play music.
Yes. Right. Okay, so thus far we sort of don't know whether that command is sort of encouraging some. I mean, those of you who are musicians, I mean, what would you think of this command? Ply the slipping string with feathery sorcery. Well, here, let me add to the ply. I went and spent some time with the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, in there, which is fabulous. It gives you a little magnifying glass. Here's some different definitions. Bend or bow, adapt or accommodate, yield or give way, handle vigorously, and I kid you not, in parentheses, an instrument or weapon. Okay, so your bow and arrow kinds of ideas, right, are actually right on. So ply has all of these layers of meaning in it. Okay, ply the slipping string with feathery sorcery. Muzzle the note with hurting love. Any comments on that one?
Muzzle is another multiple
yes.
meaning word.
Yes.
Mean to shut the mouth by muzzling the guard, but there's also the muzzle of the gun.
Yeah. Yep. The music that they wrote bewitch bewilder.
My question is the they.
Yes.
They.
Yeah. Right? And why does it become important that it's they and not you? Or we?
I don't know who the they are.
Okay.
I mean, it's
so it becomes a question of who are these others? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for great love goes with the transcendent poem.
But say it loud, yeah.
The hurting love goes with the poem, the tone sitting poem we put on the board.
Okay.
Yeah.
In both of those, the idea of feathery sorcery, mm-hmm. this is not pierce through to the back of the hall, get my mm-hmm. elbow high on my Stradivarius and knock you mm-hmm. over. This is a matter of I am playing with emotions on a small scale. To muzzle a note, some notes need to be played out, but others need to be underemphasized
huh?
in order to create expressive rhetoric.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Yeah.
What
you
use the word?
What?
You use the word mute. I mean, muzzle and mute. You know, in music, you mute yourself, right?
Yes. Well.
But, so, yeah.
I do think muzzle is keeping us connected. To
that. Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, the violence.
Yeah,
yep.
The music that they wrote, Bewitch, Bewilder, this is sort of post-World War II propaganda-y, and it could be silence their message so you make it for your own.
Mm-hmm. Right? So maybe it's taking somebody else's music and making it your own, bewitch or bewilder it, so that it's becoming your own. Yep, that's one interpretation for sure. Part of what I'm interested in this first section is what kind of advice in general is the speaker giving on how to play this instrument? Like, do we trust this advice? seduction control. Okay. We'll keep going. That's the question that I sort of have for you about this first part. Qualify to sing thread-wise. And this is what we briefly looked at the poem this morning, and somebody was like, what does that mean? So I again went to the Oxford English Dictionary and looked up qualify just to make sure we had all the qualify, to invest with a quality, to make legally capable, to make oneself competent at something, to render less violent, to appease or calm, to control or regulate, to make less perfect or complete. Does anybody, but qualified, so what, I mean, and I don't have any, this line baffles me the most, I think.
I'm a qualified, they who are qualified,
they were, yeah.
I don't know who that is, but.
Uh-huh. So qualify yourself. So make yourself competent to sing. Yeah.
Who?
Who should be doing it? Yeah.
What? They that wrote.
Well, anybody wanna?
Tell me. I don't know. Maybe.
Just get the impression of like, it's like an imperative again. Like man, they're saying. Temper yourself to speak with the music or something instead, you know?
Yeah.
Like asking you to muzzle your note and
yes.
Be like a sorcerer to be, you know, kind of tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the same thing, to temper yourself to not speak out.
So figuring out this like different way to play their music, to temper your own self, to figure out how to do this in such a way that's maybe not gonna be true. Does anybody want to tackle thread-wise as a word? Qualify to sing thread-wise?
I don't even know what it means.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's Brooks's. I mean, I looked this one up too. As far as I know, it's an invented word on her part.
Okay.
Yeah. So now we all know. So.
But it seems to go with kind of slipping string, like in, like there's a wisdom in what's going on. Are you being? Is it being a person being acted upon or acting?
Yeah.
Or don't sing with your voice. Sing through the medium of strings.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes. So that you can sing through the string. That's great. I like that a lot. Okay.
Which also can unravel.
Yeah. Yeah, thread has all of those. Well, I think of the strings, too, as threads. Right? Like on the instrument.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's kind of your... So also qualify to sing thread-wise, almost like not against the thread, but with it, you know, like not in tension with. Does that make sense at all? I don't know. In the way of the thread.
That's kind of the next sentence.
Yes, okay, let's get to that. So devise no salt, no hempen thing. And salt and hempen things, and again, here we go, hempen, made of hemp, right? So made of sort of basic things. Also, usually in humorous contexts, hempen is also a word that's often used to describe the hangman's noose. Okay, but salt and hempen things, right? Sort of basic salt is, right, one of our most basic foods that we need to sort of survive and have pleasure. It's very basic, right? And as is hemp, as a material, right? It's not devise no salt, no hempen thing, for the dear instrument to bear. Devote the bow to silks and honey. So what kind of music are you supposed to be playing, according to this teacher?
Finer.
Yeah.
Smooth.
Finer, smooth, sweet.
I also think it's the whole tone is a restrained music.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's in preparation for what's to come.
Yeah. And are you supposed to, if you're, just to introduce class into this, right? Are you supposed to sing of the ordinary, everyday things in your life? I mean, is that what you're supposed to play about? Right? That could be the contrast. myself to the salt and hidden things, right?
Non-controversial.
Yes. Silks and honey, the things that go over nicely, that seem smooth, that everybody's comfortable with, that, that sound nice.
You know, can I say something?
Yeah.
This is not, I'm not speaking directly to the poem. It's kind of really freaking me out. Because I've been writing a biography for kids about Django Reinhardt, who was a gypsy jazz guitarist in Europe and in Nazi Germany. And a lot of you already know what Hitler did with jazz, which was, he hated it, but he couldn't stamp it out because people loved it so much, and so he repressed it. And one of the other things, we were just listening to some of these lyrics online just a couple days before we left. He would take popular jazz songs, and the first verse or two would be the jazz song that people love, and so people would start, you know, singing with it, and then the next verse or two would be these nasty things about the Allies or Jews. And what he wanted people to be listening to was classical music. That was the only kind of music one should be listening to. So this is a complete digression.
No, but that's not a digression at all.
But it just is like, as I'm listening to it, it's just so creepy because it sounds, this is what it sounds like to me. I don't know what it's really about, but that's what it feels like. So, yeah.
Peter said in Paul's first session about poetry and poets speak the truth.
Huh?
And this is suggesting that during this time, poets and artists are, just go with the party line.
Yep.
Don't speak out. Don't be controversial. Just say what we want to hear and be supportive. Because if not, by the way, bad things might happen to you. But
right.
Just sort of don't lock the boat.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Be rich, be willing. Sort of don't be an artist. Just sort of keep the masses sort of calm and happy and propagandize with us and for us. We don't really need to pay attention to the bad stuff. Just you know, take a while, don't think about murder and hate and stuff like that. Just be happy about what's
going
on.
Let's do the nice things. Right, and that brings us to the last one. Be remote a while from malice and from murdering. Right? If we would just play our fiddle, we would be away from all of the other stuff, right? As though art and war and violence take place in very separate spheres, right? There's something of a like you're saying, right, like division, yeah.
One other thing that struck me in that Bewitched, Bewildered to me, and I don't know when this was written, but that song that you usually sing with that, they left out Bothered. Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered.
Oh,
and they don't want
you
to be bothered.
Interesting.
And it's jazz.
I was thinking of it.
Is it?
Yeah.
Carol Island.
Really? Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
But where did Keo originate from?
One more. Just American.
That's fabulous. So she has, that's great. So she's left out the Bothered. Wow. Oh, wow. Okay, that's
and
great.
And it also, as we're reading it to me, it's, ooh, we are lulling them into a false sense of security.
Okay.
And then we're going to give it to them.
Okay, so there's a lull, yeah. There's a musicality here, right, that also is doing some lulling, yep. Okay, so now this is, I'm sorry. What form are we dealing with here?
Sonnet,
yes. And let's just really quickly here. Anybody, I think we did rhyme scheme yesterday. Is anybody not familiar with how that? I'm going to put some letters on the board, and if you don't know what they mean, but what we're going to do is we're going to go down, and we're going to say, like, okay, string is the last word on the first line, so we're going to award that an A, like, that's the first rhyme. And then note gets a B. And then rote rhymes with note, so it gets a B, too. And then sing rhymes with
string,
so that gets an A. All right, and then what's the next one?
A.
So what letter?
A.
Uh-huh, and then what?
B.
Uh-huh.
B. A.
Okay. Then what?
C.
Uh-huh.
D.
E. D or E?
D.
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 C. same rhyme scheme. And in these, we've just done the first 8 lines, and it's all about the music part, right? Now we're going to shift, but first to arms, to armor, right? So now we're switching in this quatrain into talk about war, right? This was music, music, and now we're on to war, okay? So, but first to arms, to armor.
I think it's worth noting that
yes.
ABBA, ABBA, but actually the C rhyme and B rhyme are very close. So I think that ties the last 6 together.
Yes.
Because you still got the long A. So.
Yes. Late space, grace, space. Yes, absolutely. That's a great point. And what usually, for those of you who have studied sonnets in the past, what usually happens before this final couplet? Anyone?
Kind of turn?
Yes. Usually there's some sort of turn. Usually a sonnet makes some sort of quote-unquote argument. And right before the final couplet, there's some sort of turn in the argument. So that's kind of an expectation that people have when they read a sonnet. So, okay. But first to arms, to armor, carry hate in front of you and harmony behind. Be deaf to music and to beauty blind. What do you notice? In contrast to the lines that we've just read, any sort of differences? In... Yeah.
Seems to like lay out kind of what's happening formally in the poem too. That they're asking you to keep harmony behind you. The musical part of the poem is behind us, and it's, you're kind of forgetting that. There are more important things as you get past that.
Yeah.
Language is simpler, there's less implied meaning, it's just more meaning, not quite as staccato as the beginning.
Yeah, not quite as.
But it's very direct.
It's very direct. The sentences move more smoothly. We don't have as many semicolons in there. It's not broken up quite as much.
You didn't go to the OED for a definition.
Yes! Right, okay. So yeah, the language, the diction is more straightforward, right? There's not a lot of carry hate in front of you and harmony behind. Like, we don't have to sit there. That's not what qualifies saying thread-wise. What? But, I mean, you get it, right? You get it right away. The message is pretty clear here, right? Anything else about those lines?
It's an imperative to win.
Okay, so let's tackle this the last 2.5 lines here. Rise, so win war, rise bloody, maybe not too late for having first to civilize a space wherein to play your violin of grace. What do you notice?
There's not a given that it's going to win.
Okay, there's not a given that it's going to win.
That there will be music.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that they call it a fiddle on the first one.
Mm-hmm.
They call it a violin at the last.
Yes.
And as a hospital chaplain, we have a music for care and healing program for our cancer patients. And when you play a violin by itself, it's such a haunting, goes straight to the soul sort of music. And you wonder, is it this violin playing by itself because of what's gone before, the grief and the mourning of those that you've lost? You've won the war, but you know your soul is in a different place, and so the violin plays that mournful, sad tune. Unlike a fiddle, you know, brings
right.
you a little bit more.
No, that's really
I don't know much about music, but
no, I think that's it's. Exceptionally important that the instrument changes from fiddle to violin throughout the course of this, for sure. And I think for those reasons that you're talking about.
It seems
trouble and manipulated.
Agenda
driven,
or like, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But isn't there also tension? I mean, how can you have that graceful violin after being, after getting in the
right. Okay.
Can you really
yes.
put that aside? Mm-hmm. Play with grace in your hand.
Yeah,
you've
what
have you
gotten? Right, so that's one of the questions for sure that this poem brings up, right? Like, what kind of, what are you hearing when you hear this violin afterwards for what you've had to do to achieve that? Yeah, what other questions, or what does it make you think of, or wonder, or?
Again, I still see him, I'm still back in my gypsy land, and I see the space where there were gypsy caravans, and now there's 600,000 dead, so there's a looking space.
So space has its residence in lots of well, also, okay, and maybe you guys can help me with this, but the language is a little bit weird in this last one, okay? So you've won the war, so theoretically you've civilized the space already. If you won the war, right, that was the whole purpose of the war, to civilize the space. So win war, rise bloody, maybe you're not too late, now that you've won the war, for having first to civilize a space wherein to play your violin with grace, but the tense there seems off, right? It seems like you still have to civilize, right? That the civilizing, is that, do you see what I'm saying?
Well, maybe they're conquering people, and they have to move them out.
Yeah.
Or civilize, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah,
but
civilize is a really loaded term, right?
And they're conquered, or they have to do something with it. Well, I don't know what civilize is.
Yeah. Well, no, let's talk about that word, civilize, yeah.
Or is the implication that you have to civilize because of the war, that the war has uncivilized?
Okay, that's great. So we think we've civilized a space, but actually we're now at the point where we have to re-civilize ourselves.
Civilized it so that you have to re-civilize yourself, so that you have to re-civilize.
Okay, yeah.
I think going with that sort of implies that it's a job that's never over, that if you want to just be able to, you know, play your violin with grace, as it were, like, you're never going to find that place where everything is civilized and you can just relax and play your music, you know what I mean? Like, there's always going to be some tension between sort of a perfect place and fighting to get it.
So that time never comes. There's all, the two always have to be intertwined. Like, you can't wait to do one thing before you've done another.
Yeah. If you made this context to be the civil rights struggles of the late 50s,
mm-hmm.
The first 50s, then you could say that to civilize would be to allow civil rights to be.
Okay. But what other context is that then used in? To civilize. I mean, is it always a... Like, you're using it in a positive way, right? To bring
civil
rights.
To tame.
To tame, right?
Yeah,
like
slaves or...
Okay,
or
so we get... So
people to come in and bring your civilization to someone who's maybe a little more primitive.
Okay.
Bring them up.
So it, there's echoes of slavery in there, too. Yeah.
I think the maybe, the word maybe, really enhances the tension.
Yeah.
Because maybe not. No.
Yeah.
Maybe
you are too late.
I wouldn't actually use the word civilized and space together. I use civilized people. I'm using my heart's often used. How do you civilize a space? Why doesn't it say civilized people? So is it like a space is actually even being contaminated? Because you clean a space or you fix up a place, a space. I don't know, it's kind of those strange words we have there.
Well, it's all bloody. All these people died, and so space is bloody. Is it not? Why is it bloody?
It just makes me think about war from the perspective of the person who has to carry it out. And once you have done those things, are you now too late in your relationship to yourself to be able to play violin with grace? Are those two acts so contradictory that the same person can't carry out the same. I don't find the opposition between the top and the bottom so much.
Yeah.
My sense is that the top is a, or at least as a person who works with string players, fiddle doesn't, to a professional string player, necessarily mean hoedown music.
Uh-huh.
Professional fiddle players, professional violinists will often refer to their instrument as a fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
I think the use of fiddle is because of the Fs.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly,
yeah.
I would
yeah, yeah.
say, I don't think that we're saying that that it's not beautiful and very, I think that the opening is a very, maybe slightly edgy evocation of what a great musician does.
Okay.
And then the question at the end is, okay, Rise Bloody, you put harmony behind you. Now, have you made yourself a space for being this, or maybe not?
Yeah. Well, right, okay, so
there's also a grammatical difference because fiddle is a verb.
Yes.
And the verb for playing, there's no verb, one word verb for violining.
Right. That's true. So there at some level there are sort of artistic accessories here. You know, if you want it to be alliterative, if you want a verb, like you know, there's limited choices too, and that's part of it.
I'm sorry, John, what is your name?
Dennis.
Dennis, you said something really interesting there. You just said that violin is too close to violence.
Yeah.
And you have violin with grace, which if you sort of
yeah.
That,
working with undergraduate string players, the word violin. that's an occupational
answer. No, but I wonder if that's intentional here. That
here.
There's that similarity between those two terms. And the final, if you have that final rhyming sound and at the violin, you kind of get back to that violence thing.
Yeah. Well, and so in some ways, part of the question becomes, in this first part, we have music playing, but it's this sort of manipulated playing, right? The artist in the first section isn't entirely free to express themselves. They're playing somebody else's music. They're being told how to do it by the speaker. They're having to do it in a specific way, right? At some level, that person doesn't have the space to play their instrument. They're not allowed to talk about the salt and hempen things, the actual things that are happening in their lives, right? Their art is being manipulated and structured in a certain way, right? And so the question becomes, is the poet arguing that indeed violence is sometimes necessary in order for true art to be played, in order to have a space to do that? Or is the poem arguing for the fact that, is it a pacifist? Is it about the horrible consequences of violence? Does that make sense? I mean.
So you sort of primed us by talking
yeah.
about the form and the
yeah.
message. My experience with sonnets, this is sort of very much in the structure of a Shakespearean song, all very love song kind of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So if she's adopted the form of a love poem, but she's talking about violence and war and through promoting it, you have that same incongruous message versus form that you have up here with Bobby and Sarah.
Command to us. First fight, then fiddle. But then what happens in the poem? What do we do first? gunfight, right? So the person gives a command, and then immediately what follows is in some ways contradictory to that initial command, too. So, but what do you guys ultimately think? What are we being...
Well, I'll make a comment.
Yeah, please.
War, come and go. There are periods of time, but music is always here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what that
means. Yeah. That's great. Thank you.
Who wants to make the comment about maybe in the
Andy.
You're right. Is that maybe not too late? Maybe you haven't sold your soul.
I think, too, Ricky was talking about jazz during World War II, but also those stories about Jews in concentration camps, right? Having to be little like orchestras, right, for the Nazis, right? So in the middle of the concentration camp, having to play these classical melodies on, you know, while your families are sort of being led off to the gas chambers.
And they thought of civil.
Can we make a connection to the title of the book, The Children of the Poor?
Mm-hmm.
Because it could be the larger war idea, but looking at the time in which he wrote it and the children, the poverty situation then, I imagine a very small house with a lot of people living in it, so that life felt maybe like war.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you carve out your own space? A peace within that kind of situation where that's where you live and
yep.
Everybody's struggling and it feels like this fighting and fiddling fast
yep.
action and where is there peace in the chaos?
Yeah,
could
that
be
wonderful.
Some connection by looking at that?
And I think it's important to mention sort of historic context-wise, a couple of her other sonnets in this, I don't know if it's in this sequence or a different place in the book, also deal with the fact that African-American soldiers sent off to World War II got to feel like they were heroes, like they were part of the country, like they belonged, and then got back and then were essentially shat upon again, right? Like then did all these great things, fought for our country, and returned to a country that didn't respect them at all anymore. So there's a lot of different historical layers kind of going on. Martha, were you going to say something?
Well, yeah. Not quite related to what you just
said.
No,
it doesn't
matter. Okay. Well, I think that she's showing that there can be no demarcation between art and war, really. And even, like, her form, like, it feels forced in that, what you just first said about how she kind of says first fight, then fiddle, and then she starts talking about fiddling. And then, like, just how the quatrains... The first two are about music and then it goes into war, but it's kind of forced a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And even in her wordplay, I like the line, carry hate in front of you and harmony behind, because she's suggesting that they're separate things, and yet harmony and hate sound
a lot
that, you know, very similar. And she's suggesting almost that, like, if you choose war, if you choose this, if you choose war, you're going to adopt the rhetoric of war in all of the other things that you do. So that the fiddle playing, as it's depicted at the beginning, it's very militaristic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it spills into art, inevitably. It can't be remote from malice and murder.
Yeah.
It cannot be.
Yeah. But that is the moment where we know that she is being ironic.
Yeah, she's being
level.
Ironic there.
Yeah,
sure.
But there's no way you can be remote if you're...
Yeah.
Oh, and because I don't hear well, somebody may already have said this.
That's okay. It's good for us
but
to hear things again anyway.
I look at the poem and say, okay, it says fight and then play. And I would suspect that some people who think we need to build up our defenses in order to be safe, that they will say, well, we've got to fight. We've got to be ready to fight.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if you look at that from this circular point of view, that, well, if we fight and we make a safe place, then we will have to fight again. And there is no end to that circle. This poem doesn't tell us how to end it. But that's something that we have to work out for ourselves. Because obviously, fight and then play is pretty problematical.
Yeah.
In terms of whether you'll end up
just
being
in
able
the same
to play.
Cycle.
So
it's so sort of, in some ways you're echoing too what Martha's saying, that the speaker begins by pretending like these things can be separated in some way, and that ultimately they can't, and that ultimately if you, like, sonnet is like a little song, right? And so ultimately what this becomes is a song in which the two are combined, right? That's how she is saying to us about this, that even though the imperative is to do one and then the other, here ultimately the song does both, or tries to, whether it's ironic or sincere or not, they're ultimately both present there. Yeah.
I don't know how much this is related, but my first thought when we read the last two lines about having first to civilize a space where to play event was Virginia Woolf, A Room of One's Own.
Yeah.
And like they.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah. And so writing being the art there,
mm-hmm.
and like not being able to quite separate rights for women from writing.
Yep.
You know, and that.
No, that's
you
terrific.
You have to.
Yeah.
You need a space, an outlet for that writing or something like that. And women's rights, in some ways, a fight, you know, and so, I don't know how those are related, and then like violin and art and fighting, I don't know, similar themes. And,
No, I like that, and that gets back to your name.
Cindy,
a little bit what Cindy was saying, in some ways, about the personal space at home, you know, like how do we create that space is necessary for art, even if obviously these aren't the ends to which or the way that we want to get there, but at some level space is sometimes needed to create art. Yeah, that's a true
thing. One thing that's kind of that I really like about the poem is that it even though it's pretty, in a sense, abstract, I mean, we're not in any concrete place,
mm-hmm.
it really seems to open up a space for us to create our own images within the poem and our own ideas of what it's about. It's very, like, open to that. I saw a lot of things as I was reading this poem, even though there's nothing, you know, there's not visual scenes. Like, first fight, then fiddle, I immediately saw, I mean, Nero fiddled while Rome burned. That's the first, that was the first thing that kind of, so I just thought it was pretty amazing in that way, that it just opened, it creates a lot of space.
Just a little prefix.
Yeah.
I'm a person who, as a musician, appropriates poetry. So I go to a poem and then I figure out what it means and then I decide to use it. So I'll just give you. I just let you know, I tend to be not cut and dried in many things, but this is one of them.
Yeah.
But for me, when I read First Fight, Then Fiddle, and I missed your opening, so you're committed to this, the juxtaposition of those is almost questionable. Can you really do this? And then as I look down in the poem and I see "When war lies bloody," I see those two phrases as being parallel. And when war, but you rise bloody. So this increases the question about whether can you really be a fighter and then play the slipping stream with feathery sorcery? And as an artist, I have to say, oh, that's a big question. I know people who have come out of one into the other, so life is rich and people are resilient, but to me it's a cautionary.
Yeah.
I think when we first started talking about this, that it sounded so much like you might take the word specifically war too literally to mean war, but then after hearing someone mention like civil rights movement and Anna mention the fight for women's rights, I've kind of flip-flopped on it. I thought it just seemed like an anti-war poem. And even that's after seeing first that it sounds like a war poem. And then you flip-flop and say, oh no, wait, it's an anti-war poem. And then to think about it a little more, it really seems like something that it's just more of a story about what everybody has to do. That I think it's not saying that you should not fight. It really implies that you must fight, and it's unfortunate. But what sort of art is going to come out of that fight?
Yeah.
So it's not saying to do one or the other. It really sort of saying that you have to do them both. I'm sorry.
Well, that's a great place to sort of wrap things up. Denise Levertov said, you can't write a poem out of ought to. You can't write a poem that just has a clear message about how you're supposed to live one way or the other, that you're not supposed to fight, or that you are supposed to fight, or that you are supposed to do. You shouldn't create art if there's war going on. So I think in some ways the beauty of the poem is that it doesn't entirely reveal itself, that it leaves us in a place of not being sure, what exactly, there's sincere moments and ironic moments here, and I think it leaves us with more questions than answers, but I think that's the right place to be in.
Ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But thank you, my friends, for wrestling with this one today. It really helped me a lot. So thank you for all your comments. Tomorrow we're going to be discussing a poem by a white female poet who wrote around the same time, Elizabeth Bishop. And her poem also at some level has to do with war, but a little bit later on and in a very different sort of context. So I thought they would be two interesting ones to put next to each other. Very different. Going about it a very different way. But thank you for coming and enjoy lunch.